Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 414th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor, and I'm the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And we're all, James and I, we're all part of PEER.
Yeah, and I'm going to say I'm going to tell you some depressing news. Everything that Mike says that he's done, he's never really done. He's faked it the whole time.
That's right.
But unfortunately, because it's so depressing, we have to talk about antidepressants, and we've been doing that for a couple of podcasts. So if you just recap what we've done, and then we'll go forward.
Right. So we talked about a screening test for depression. It's just two things for, and it's not really screening, it's case finding. Yeah. So these are patients that are equivocal, and you say, during the past month, have you been bothered by feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, or have little interest or pleasure in doing things? And if both of those are negative, it's very helpful in ruling out depression. So the negative likelihood ratio is 0.015. So basically, you take someone with something around a 15% chance of having the disorder down to a 1% chance. So it's really good for just making sure you've kind of excluded that. Then we talked about the limitations in the evidence, which are concerning, but don't prevent us from getting some good information from them. And we talked about how severity matters in the sense of how much over a placebo effect, what your number needed to treat is. But it really doesn't matter in the sense of for the front line for us. We're going to see about 50 to 60% of people get better who are moderately depressed or more severely depressed. It's just in clinical trials, you'll see that the number needed to treat look better for more severe. Then we talked about, is one antidepressant better than the other? And we kind of went through the evidence quite carefully and showed you that no, any study showing that one is better than the other, within a couple of years, the order of what's the best is shifted around all over again, because there's so many biases susceptible to misinterpretation. Yeah. That it's just reshuffling a deck, really. Anytime you do the analysis, it's like a card game.
Yeah. So, and we did make the caveat, though, is there's no doubt some people will respond to one and not the other. Although even that is tricky, because it may be the time that you gave the second one, they just happen to be getting better. And so it's very tricky. But there are likely people who do respond to different ones. And again, that can only be that clinical trials don't help us with that. So So where are we going to go from here?
So we're going to talk about some of the nuances of management of antidepressants, the management of depression using antidepressants, and like the whole idea of what dose do you use, mm-hmm. how quick do you switch the dose, how quick do you switch to a new medicine, all of those kind of things. And we're going to put that in context of what the evidence is starting to reveal. Here we are literally, 30 years, 50 years, depending on what drug class you count from, into treating depression, and we're just now getting a better picture. So let's jump to that. The first thing is dose. So we've talked about this in the past, that fluoxetine, for example, James, I think you were the first one to show me this trial at 5 versus 20 versus 40, were really very similar in outcomes, or the same. And tricyclics, amitriptyline 50 to 100 versus greater than 100 had the same results.
Yeah, but I'm sure you remember, I mean, it used to be you had to push one of the management issues in the treatment of depression was you've got to push the doses. And I remember for like the tricyclics, it was up to 300.
I know, which is, kind of cruel and in retrospect.
And again, done with the best of intentions. And it didn't come from really solid research. It came from sort of nuanced looks at different doses. And they really weren't designed to do that. And we now have reasonably good evidence, at least for some, that lower doses work, and we should know that anyway.
Lower doses work, and the differences in increasing dose are small. So let's talk a little bit about that. There was a systematic review that looked at 8 studies, and increasing the dose in those in the subgroup that had a poor response early on. And this was increasing the dose kind of before 8 weeks had passed. And what they found was there was no help from escalating the dose within the first 8 weeks. Another 9 RCT systematic review was published, and they looked at what about waiting 3 to 6 weeks, taking the people who aren't responding, and then doubling the dose or staying the same. So 9 RCTs in this, and between doubling the dose or staying the same, the standard mean difference, so James will talk a little bit about what that means, but it's 0.053, not statistically significant anyway. But if it's less than 0.2, most people would say that it's probably meaningless.
Yeah.
And this is 0.053. So again, meaningless.
Yeah.
And the odds ratio response, which if anything should exaggerate any of the effectiveness, was not remotely statistically significant at 1.1 with a confidence interval between 0.8 and 1.6. So this is probably the best evidence we have showing that that escalating the dose quickly is not of benefit. And then there's a large systematic review with 135 placebo-controlled trials that looked at did dosing matter when the response rates compared across studies. So this has weaknesses because it's a compared across studies, but it just supports, again, what we've seen is that dosing early on does not seem to impact outcomes, at least in that first 8-week window.
Yeah. So when you look at this, so it does kind of, you got to try and figure out, so what do you do with all this stuff? Because, you know, go ahead.
Yeah. I think we can put that in context in a second, James, because I think there's a really interesting research that's starting to come out about how long it takes for the original response and then how long before everyone kind of who could respond gets a chance to respond.
Right.
Like how quick is that response curve flattening out? And when are you still getting some effect? So let's actually move on to the other side of the coin, the idea of switching. And that is, so people aren't responding, so now you're going to switch. You're not going to double the dose. You're going to switch to a new drug entirely. And this comes from a systematic review. We're going to look at a couple of these, with the first one with 3 randomized control trials, that what they did is they switched after 6 to 7 weeks to see if that could help out, and versus staying on the same drug, even though you weren't responding. And the odds ratio was 0.85, meaning that if it wasn't statistically significant, but it's saying to us that if anything, it's trending towards the idea of switching early.
Mm-hmm.
The next systematic review was 8 RCTs with 1,600, and they looked at after 2 weeks switching. And so they generally switch somewhere between 4 to 12 weeks. And the change in depression scale had a standard mean difference of 0.031. Again, not statistically significant. Odds ratio right almost exactly 1. This is really strongly demonstrating that switching early on is not a great idea. Kind of after 2 weeks, don't look to switch right away. And the STAR-D trial, which waited at least 12 weeks before switching, also found, we'll present some of that data later, but I think it serves as a good guide to reminding us that we shouldn't be rushing to doubling the dose or switching or anything like that.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we'll sort of give some an approach after you've gone through most of the evidence.
Right. And so the next piece is how fast do they work, period? Like, so when should I kind of expect to get a response? And I remember quite clearly when I was in medical school being told that if a patient comes back at a week or two and says they're feeling better on their antidepressant, then that must be a false result. And they and my teachers told me, be careful of personality disorder.
Right. No. The comment was I remember being told is, you'll see almost nothing in the first 2 weeks.
Right. And so the evidence and that was because the trials were so small, there was no way they could tease this out. But now that we have, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people studied, we're starting to see the actual timing of response. And basically 1/3 of the benefit that people get from an antidepressant, if you follow just 6 weeks, and I'll show you why we should even follow longer. Mm-hmm. But if you follow just 6 weeks, 1/3 of the benefit occurs in the first 7 days.
Mm-hmm. That's going to vary. And when we say benefit, it's on a scale.
That one's on a scale.
And it's different scale. And it depends, you know, some people will notice that they may even feel a little less depressed. Some people will say they're sleeping a little bit better, or people will say they're not sleeping as much, or whatever it is. That's what we're talking about. This, it's not, it's looking at different types of scales.
Right. And exactly as you said, James, for every person, there'll be, you know, same level of depression, same general person, you know, like a male in their 40s, in middle class employment, etc. And he'll given both, and I'm picking a drug at random, fluoxetine. They'll both say, "Well, yeah, it's helping me a little bit. I'm sleeping less. And this one's helping me a little bit. I'm not getting angry at work." And whatever that, it's quite unpredictable, but on average, when you look at the number of people, it's about 1/3 of the benefit occurs in that 7-day period. And then if you try to figure out how many get as good as a 50% response, the number needed to treat is 25. So in the first 7 days. So right. It's not a great number needed to treat, but it is showing us that some people are getting a pretty good improvement quickly.
Yeah. And that's all over placebo. So it's not like we're saying that, you know, they're just getting better. Like you said, 50 to 60% of people will respond in primary care when you give them an antidepressant. The majority of that is because of what's going on in the placebo group. You're talking above placebo.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So it's an effect from the medication in the first 7 days, which is in contrast to what many of us who've been in practice a long time said, we were not given that message.
Exactly the opposite message. Yeah, really, you and I both said.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with anything like this, we'd want to know, is this the first one to, like, is this the only study to verify this? Well, there's been others subsequently that have shown that clinical response can occur as early as 1 week, and other research showing that the response is generally, like many interventions, kind of front loaded and kind of dwindles over time. So, so you get less and less happening, but it does remind us that you don't like, for many patients, when they're coming back and saying, "I'm starting to feel better at 1 or 2 weeks," that doesn't mean that they're exaggerating, that there's some big placebo response. They might actually be benefiting from the drug that early. And that leads us to, so just how much benefit do we continue to accrue over time? And this was a really good little study published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. And what they looked at was kind of pooled responses from some double-blind studies of how the response curve looks for both placebo and antidepressants. And it was published in May or June in 2018. And what they showed was that, again, the response is kind of front-loaded, but, you know, the percent who get a response occurs, it's about 42% of people in that kind of 4-week interval. In the intervention arm, in the treatment arm, at 8 weeks, it goes from 42%. Now it's at 55%. And at 12 weeks, it's 60%. Okay. So what I want to focus on here for a second is the idea that somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks, you're about 40 to 50% of people are better. And at 12 weeks, 60% are better. So if we kind of average the 4 to 8 week out, it's somewhere around 50% are better. And if you wait a full 12 weeks, then 60% are better.
Yeah. And in looking at this, you could still go, you know, if you haven't gotten better at 4 weeks, there's not much more to go. I mean, you might get another 10% improving, but, you know, it's much of the effect, you know, the greatest percentage is in the first 4 weeks.
But remember what we said, James.
Yeah.
When you look at the placebo and the drug, overall, you're getting somewhere between a 40 and 50 response in placebo at the end of study. And in the drug arm, you're getting 50 to 60. So the difference there is about 10%.
Yeah.
The difference between 4 weeks and 12 weeks is a little bit better than 10%. So you can imagine if I switched you to a new drug and you started the curve all over again versus just continuing on, you'd be better off almost always waiting.
Yeah. No,
because you're still accruing benefit as time goes on. As we talked about, the benefit of drug over placebo is relatively, you know, it's 10, maybe 15% in the best case scenario. And that's the kind of differences you're seeing between 4 and 12 weeks. So waiting it out versus quick changes, you will not be able to tease those out. And I think this study was very enlightening for me to say, this puts in context why these dose increases didn't find a difference, why the switching to new drugs doesn't find a difference. Mm-hmm. It's because if you leave people alone, there's still about, a number of them are still accruing, about 5 to 15% of them are still going to find a benefit. And that's about the difference between placebo anyway. Mm-hmm. So just leaving them alone to accrue that benefit is probably just as good as switching them around. Now, if someone's profoundly ill and all of that stuff, obviously as a clinician we'll want to be more active and aggressive depending on the severity of the depression.
Right.
But for the majority, this speaks to the importance of patience and allowing the medication to have an effect rather than rushing and changing. All we're doing there is increasing the odds of an adverse event or something bad happening, increasing the cost of drugs, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and although we know there's going to be a bunch of caveats to that, but you know, for instance, you know, if you see absolutely no response in 4 weeks, you might do something different. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
You know, so that everything that Mike is talking about, and very legitimate, is these are averages. And mm-hmm. then you've got to deal with the person who's in front of you. And if they have zero, like it would bother me if they had no demonstrable benefit over the first 2 to 3 weeks, I'd be going, that's not a good sign.
Yeah. You're right. So if I was at 4 to 6 weeks and they had found nothing except adverse events, I would probably be tempted to switch earlier. But if as in the case, it so often happens in my practice, well, I'm not sure. I think I'm sleeping a little, I'm not sure, but I'm, you know, blank. Maybe I'm not so sad and I'm a little more comfortable chatting with friends. I don't get as edgy, those kind of things. I'd be very tempted to stay the course and not rush. Where the old teaching for me was, if they don't have a full response, you know, throw the book at them, give them everything, bigger doses, switching medicines, augmenting. And the research here showing this kind of time effect and analysis is so important, I think, to remind us that if you're getting hints, don't be panicked and rushed to make big changes, because people can be getting better.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And for sure, you know, especially when you start a medication, you know, in the first week or so, they're going to notice the side effects associated with it, whether it be, you know, sedation or stimulation, depending on the antidepressant, or dry mouth or whatever. And those may peak at, you know, a week or so, but people tend to tolerate those better, or at least work around it. And one of the best ways to tolerate those, not tolerate them, it is to reduce the risk of those, is to start with much lower doses, as you talked about, with, you know, sort of 5 or fluoxetine. So that's sort of the discussion that you need to have with people is, you may start to get some of the side effects early, but those should probably dissipate. And then you might get the effect in the sort of the response rate over time that you're talking about.
Yeah. And James is suggesting 5 of the challenge with 5 of fluoxetine is you have to, that's a liquid based.
I was just speaking generically, if you will. We'll get to the nuances of that in a minute.
Generically.
But yeah.
I agree. And I generally start moderately low doses, generally the smaller pills that I can prescribe, and then try and wait it out much more than I used to.
Yeah.
And look for those subtle differences that we've been talking about. Let's talk a tiny bit about the STAR-D trial, because I think it offers a little bit of insight into the course of the management of depression. And the STAR-D trial is a study that was done in Great Britain where they managed it mixed between psychiatry offices and family doctor offices. And the big thing here is that they included everybody. Many of the clinical trials that we've discussed up till now have what they've done is excluded a lot of people that you and I have in our practices. So, many times in a depression trial, the patients have no comorbid illnesses of any type. They've never had a history of suicide. This is their first depressive episode. All sorts of features like that, where in reality, most of my patients who are in for depression have I would go as far as to say most have some kind of recurrent. This has happened to them before. They have some challenges with psychiatry in other ways, be it personality, be it substance use, be another psychiatric condition like ADHD or what have you. They have and some have attempted self-harm, etc. And so those the patients like that are often excluded from trials, making it hard to interpret what really would happen to our true patients. So in this one, 80% had recurrent depression or chronic depression, 18% had attempted suicide. So they really were patients who were a little bit more our typical patients. And we call it a trial, but it really wasn't a trial. They were allowed to pick which way they went. And so they were all given citalopram early on and had their dose titrated up. And after 12 weeks, the mean dose was right around 40 milligrams. And for those who hadn't had a response and they wanted you to have actual remission, which means that you were no longer depressed anymore. And we've talked about that's a little bit harder to attain. But of those, they said, would you like to go on and try the next step, which was either augmenting or switching to a new antidepressant? And then if that failed, then they were offered again, do you want to switch or augment? And I'll jump right to the chase. So the first round, about 30% had remission from citalopram. The next round, it was around 25%, virtually no matter what you did. And the next round, it was about 20% had remission, virtually no matter what you picked to do. So the thing that kind of stuck out was buspirone. That was less effective for augmenting than bupropion. But otherwise, like whether you're picking sertraline, bupropion, or venlafaxine to switch to, the results were very, very similar. So it's just a reminder to us that, again, all of the worry about exactly what you do in exactly what step, it probably doesn't matter as much as we worry about, or that some people seem to think makes a huge difference based on one clinical trial. This study is a much more comprehensive, much more predictive of our real populations, and it showed that people will get better with the things that we do, and the exact thing that we do, it really doesn't matter that much, whether it's switching or augmenting or whatever, once they've had a fair trial.
Yeah. And I think it's important because so much of the literature in psychiatry and with antidepressants is, you know, talking about the effect that they have on, you know, different
neurohormones.
And I think, you know, a lot of what we've, you know, seen in the past when we talk about the different antidepressants is their different effect on the neurohormones. And, you know, one has this effect and one has that effect. And, you know, as much as I've ever tried to find evidence that it makes any difference, we get very hung up on these mechanisms of action, even though almost none of the time has there been a clinical trial showing that because of those potential differences that one is better or different than another. And I think we have to be very careful with the advertising that says one is more selective for this or non-selective or whatever it is, because I'm sure you've seen those, the adverts and actually, you know, a number of people who are very, very interested in how these things work will talk about them in a way to suggest that the differences are because of the effect that they have, when in fact a lot of it is just BS.
It's BS. And then once you take all of that and translate it into an individual, it just becomes such a wash, even if there was an element of truth to it. And we've seen this time and time again. I think I've told you one of my favorite, one of my residents came back and told me what he had been taught by an obstetrics and gynecologist specialist, and it was about the birth control pill, and he said he listens to the gynecologist, listens to the woman's concerns, tries to figure out whether it's, you know, more of the estrogen effect, yeah, or more of the progesterone effect, and which hormones within the estrogen group or progesterone group have a certain levels of effect in certain areas. He weighs all of that, all the symptoms, all the signs, then goes to the cupboard and picks the prettiest box.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly.
because it's too many variables to actually know with confidence. Now, some people will tell you they do absolutely know, but I struggle to believe that's real. That those differences are real.
And I know you don't have it in the slide set that we're talking from, but there was a study, I'm thinking 10 to 15 years ago, where they actually tried to target the initial choice of the antidepressant on the symptom, on the main symptoms that that person had.
Right, you know, I've seen that, where you're using the kind of adverse event profile.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Well, this has more of a positive effect on the MADRS scale, so we'll use it because you have a higher score on the MADRS than you do on the HAM-D and blah, blah, blah.
And it was a complete wash.
None of that matters. It's so much like the whole idea that we just saw with the clinical trial of low carb versus low fat.
Oh, yeah.
And now we'll add in the nuances of genetics, and I'm sure that will make it finally show
nothing.
A huge difference. And it was, in the end, there was absolutely no effect from your genetic makeup, even if you had all of the kind of genes that we believe make you susceptible to a low fat diet or what have you. Like, it's crazy that we think we understand these things. It's like getting a tiny glimpse of something and then making a series of assumptions.
Oh yeah. And then you can go back to the whole selective, non-selective nonsense with beta blockers. I mean,
there's so many examples, James. Yeah. We digress. Let's finish up the STAR-D trial. So the STAR-D trial overall, that the efficacy population, so kind of the best case scenario, was a 52% versus a 39%. And the reason it didn't look quite as good is they were looking at a harder to treat population, but still about 50 versus 40. So not far from what we've seen before.
And as you pointed out, they were looking at remission.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a remission piece here that was making it really hard. Much harder. So the take-home messages, though, from the STAR-D trial were choosing the type of the alternative different antidepressants did not matter. What they also found was whether you were in the specialist care, like a psychiatrist or a GP's care, it really didn't matter. Patients did the same. And the choice of augmentation is the biggest weakness in this study, because they were using things that aren't typically used in primary care, like lithium and T3 and things like that, where we would augment more with antipsychotics or certain types of antidepressants and that. And I'll get into that a little bit more in the next podcast. But it did show us that although the augmentation part of the study was weaker, that switching and all of that, really, it doesn't matter what you choose. A similar number of people are going to get better.
Right. So I think, as you point out, we're just about the end of the time for the podcast. So why don't we're going to talk about combining antidepressants in the next podcast and also adding in other agents like the antipsychotics and so on. Does that work for you, Mike?
Yeah. So we'll talk about the combinations. We'll talk a little bit about when to withdraw, and then because we've been completely neglectful of it, we'll talk a little bit about non-pharmaceutical interventions for depression.
And then at the end, we'll sort of wrap it up with some sort of
in a tight little package. With a nice bow.
Nice little bow on it, and you could give it to anybody for Christmas.
And boy, would they appreciate that!
Oh yeah,
like so, a lump of coal.
Yeah, so we'll put all that together in a package about given all of the information, like what's a reasonable thing to start with, what's a reasonable dose, and all that sort of stuff. But you'll have to wait till we get to that podcast. So I don't think we have anything to sell, because by the time you guys hear this podcast, our course in Vancouver will have been a unrivaled success.
A smashing success.
Yeah, the critics will be all over it, and I won't say which direction. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.